Welcome, everybody. Delighted and honored that you're here and that we get to keep moving forward. Most precious understanding of first century Aramaic forgiveness. And Dr. Tim, if you happen to still be listening, I was listening to part of the conversation you had with Susan, and I'm certainly with you with the beauty of this tool that Yeshua gave us of forgiveness is anybody can use it and produce a result. And your expert facilitation is also a powerful assist in doing the process. And I'd support you receiving acknowledgement for that. You know, you look at the situation where the woman who has the 12-year issue of blood knows that all she needs to do is to touch the hem of his garment. She's willing, she's doing her work, but she doesn't quite have the vitality to move through it. And he provides that. And he gives the credit to her, as you gave to Celinda, for doing the work. And without the hem of his garment, she probably wouldn't have gone there. And so I'd support you just receiving the acknowledgement as the one, having done enough work to be the space, and two, so that the hem of your garment reaches out, and two, that you do, you know, tilt and direct the boat. You know, the power that runs the boat is the motor, no question about it, but without the trim, that boat goes some crazy places. So I acknowledge that in you, and thank you for it. And beyond that, I know there were a couple of people who were talking about calling in, so Miss Jeannie, I'll check with you first before we go anywhere else and see if we've got anybody on the phone queue with a hand up or anything happening in the chat room.
All of the hands that are up were left over from Dr. Tim, and nothing's going on in the chat room. But hopefully Blog Talk will stay up for us because the last 3 minutes of Dr. Tim's show, it kind of glitched in and out. But it seems to be strong right now. And we have several listeners, so press 1, and that puts you into queue. And Celinda's hand just went up, 541. You're on the air. Hi, Celinda.
Hi,
hey there, young lady.
Myself. I'm good. And you?
I'm rocking. Doing well.
And you, and Jeannie? Bless her heart. I'm so glad she's so skilled in that department that keeps us on so we can stay on the radio show.
I'm with you on that one.
I
there wouldn't be one without her. It would have stopped a long, long, long time ago.
I know. She is our expert facilitator. I committed to calling in today, so I'm calling in today. I don't know if you heard any of my conversation with Dr. Tim.
I did.
When I mentioned starting off, because I realized I had fallen right back into my unawareness by saying I'm trying to recover from my worksheet and with Dr. Tim. And for me, the immediate image I had in my mind, because I seemed to go immediately to images and metaphors, was this manhole cover being plopped back over all of the stuff down there. So I had to chuckle that and do an immediate canceling and say I am uncovering some more of my worksheet, which I did in the next 24 hours.
That's awesome. You know, it's interesting, the word that's been, or words have been translated as the kingdom of heaven can be translated two ways in Aramaic. One is as the community of love, and second is the kingdom of expansion. And once you open a dynamic, the expansion, if there's willingness, can continue. I've watched people do a worksheet or do a still point session, and literally 2 months later, they're ego balance, their ego mind is still unfolding and processing from that. So joining you in that expansion.
I love also that I love those two definitions, and I also love Neil Douglas Klotz's definition of the kingdom, what he calls the kingdom of God. He calls it the I can. The heaven is the I am, and our earthly kingdom is I can, and that just fits right in with the what did you say about expansion? The
kingdom of expansion is within.
The kingdom.
As you start doing your work.
Yeah. Well, I'm in my queendom, sir, right here. And because I happen to be running around with a female personality and body traits. So I'm Queen Elizabeth at the moment, hopefully, cancel the thought. I'm in my queendom of expansion, and I am so grateful for everything, as I mentioned to Dr. Tim. My rabbit holes either lead to dead ends or they lead to more expansion as I realize that I don't have to do anything. I have the opportunity at a portal where I end up, which looks like a dead end, to trust and surrender. And that is not a left brain process, believe me.
Right. Well, it's interesting. You mentioned the Corpus Callosum. And, they still have Einstein's brain in a laboratory somewhere. I forget where it is. Princeton, maybe.
Oh.
But when they looked at his brain, the only thing that was different from any other brain that they'd studied, the major they were looking, with his genius, there's got to be some major difference. And the major difference was the connectedness in the corpus callosum. The left and right hemispheres being one instead of separate, which that physiological separation might just be an expression of what we've done with our minds, and it's time to reconnect.
That's so beautiful, because that, you know, this whole concept of neuroplasticity now and how they're beginning to realize it's not just about different parts of the brain being able to take over, but it's also about how flexible and how rigid that brain is, or that entity is, as a result of what's happening with the neuroplasticity. And it reminds me of a talk a CD set that I had, where the two gentlemen, the gentleman that was giving the talk, said that one of the ways you can tell when someone has a post-traumatic stress disorder is because they will flip between rigidity and chaos. I had the image I got was this talk we've been doing on the show about neuroplasticity, and I thought, oh yes, I have been there many, many times between chaos and rigidity, and maybe it's a matter of degree rather than kind as to when PTSD becomes, and I don't like labels, but the symptoms of PTSD become so obvious. Does that make any sense?
Yeah, and, you know, the world has created a label of how it's a disorder, post-traumatic stress. But actually, I think that's a label that's inappropriate. Yes, many people have post-traumatic stress, but it's not a disorder. It's an adaptation that allows people to survive, not as the normal brain would, because of the assault that's happened. And as we learn to soften, because the brain reflects through the whole body, as you start to pay attention to your physiology and where tensions are, where rigidity is, you know, the rigid body cannot flow through the range of frequencies it's designed to receive, and therefore there tends to be dysfunction where the antenna, so to speak, isn't allowed to bring in the frequencies that are needed. And so that definitely paying attention to where tensions are, learning to let chronically tightened muscles and therefore chronic sympathetic dominance go. And as we let it go, everything, the fluidity of the form and the mind. I remember there's a gentleman that introduced me, actually, well, we've known each other almost 50 years. He's a fellow naturopath. But he does a thing that he calls centerline balancing, where he works to bring the body into its natural alignment. He does this work sitting in a chair. And I can remember back, oh, this is probably 12 years ago or so, he did a centerline balancing session with me just before I was getting ready to do a workshop. And I went into that workshop, and my mind, my creative flow, my ability to put ideas together was like beyond anything I'd ever experienced. And, you know, that's after 40 years of presenting. It was just monumental, the difference in the flow of energy, not only in this comfort of my physiology, but the flow with my mind was just awesome. I mean, like it was that dramatic after one session of sitting in the chair, and he's balancing, bring that center line balancing. So what we do with our physiology is definitely a key part of it.
I love that, and it reminds me of the previous thing we were talking about PST, reminds me of your comments a couple of shows ago, I believe, about multiple personalities, because we all have aspects of multiple personalities, but we only call it a disorder when it seems to solidify in the polar areas of one or the other, of rigidity or chaos or whatever happens with multiple personalities. And yeah. I would love to go ahead.
No, I wasn't.
I would love. I'm doing my best to learn to leave a longer space between when I think someone is done and when they're actually done. Thank you. I'd love to go back to the thought that we got cut off by the show the other day on the breath and the physiology and what it actually does about opening up things in the cellular structure or on the skin of the membrane of the cell, which is now being considered as the brain of the cell, rather than a mitochondria, which is more the adrenals of the cell. So I thought maybe you could explore that a little bit with us, because that was a real breath opener for me, literally. Like hope. Mm. Oh, I can learn how to breathe again.
Right.
After 68 years.
Yeah. Well, 68 years and 100 generations.
Yes.
1,000 generations, because those things are physiologically, mentally, and emotionally patterned, would be my take. And that's why, as you pay attention to it, you can tend to interrupt the patterns more easily as you become more conscious. And the action of breath, you know, if you go back to Yeshua, he consented to going through being dunked in water, which was called baptism, and he never dunked anybody in water after that. He consented once because it was a Jewish tradition, but he didn't ever baptize anybody. And it's interesting how there are, you know, whole groups of people who follow a guy and call themselves baptizers, but he never did it. And they, you know, they talk about the importance of dunking in water, but what Yeshua did was he baptized them in the Spirit. And baptized isn't a mystical religious tradition. My offering is that it's the thing that facilitates the movement of energies in the system, and in particular energies in the system that don't belong. So when they talk about, and, you know, I'm always looking to get everything down to physiology and down to the real world where we live. And if you think about, you know, the symbolic act of pouring water on someone is washing, cleaning, cleansing, but it's a symbol. The real baptism, Yeshua did baptize, nothing to do with water, but he baptized them in Ruach HaKodesh, in the breath. And the breath for the forgiveness of sins means that if I have and remembering that the Aramaic word sin simply is an archery term that means off the mark, if I have an energy in me that's off the mark, I will tend to, if I'm not willing, shut down my breath to close that energy down somewhere in tissue, because when I put an energy in tissue that doesn't belong, the tissue complains. It says, ouch, it hurts. And most people, where it hurts, they literally, physiologically shut their breath out of that tissue so they can hold on to their sin, their energy that's off the mark. And, you know, when you tie that in with the Aramaic idea that Satan in Aramaic is not some dude with a red suit, a tail, and a pitchfork, it means the resistor, one who misleads. It means being stuck in carbon-based memory, the mind of man, the carbon-based memory system, formulating our perceptual constructs rather than the actuality of the Creator's creation coming in and forming our constructs. And that story where he directly calls Peter Satan, and then he explains what he means. For you think in the mind, you think in carbon-based memory, Adamos. You're stuck in the storage device, and everything you're experiencing is coming from your past. And when we shut the breath out of that, then we lock those things literally into tissue. This is the physiological effect, and my offering is that that's the only cause of disease that there is locking energies into tissue that don't belong. And when we start to access those things, standing in willingness and being paying attention and bringing the breath to literally the tissue, Adamos, the red clay where trauma is stored, and being able to restore the breath, put the breath back in that place and displace the energy that doesn't belong. And most people resist that process. No, I don't want to feel. I don't want to deal with that. And so the restoration of the breath, and you look at that word store, what are we doing? We're storing. We're taking the breath into that place where something of a deleterious nature has been stored. We get to feel it. And that's where instead of tightening, going into resistance, literal, physiologically inhibiting the flow of energy in the structure to restore the breath, to bring the breath into those places which displaces the sin energy, the energy that is off the mark that's causing problems in tissue and reflecting as pain, and literally breathing for the forgiveness of sin, of using the breath to remove from the structure whatever never belonged. And you know, it's been 40-some years since I started doing still-point breathing with people, and thousands of people, and every kind of trauma and drama that you can think of, I've watched people have surface, and what I learned was to simply trust that the breath knows how to diffuse that pained energy. And when someone will actually breathe into a space where there's trauma and continue to utilize that still point breath, it will literally clean the database out of everything that never belonged. The forgiveness of sins, the removal of what doesn't belong. It's like this is real physiology where we live. It's not about some, you know, theological religious idea. It's just being restored to the, literally, quite literally, to the breath of the Creator.
Well, I can share with you that making that concrete bridge for me was like giving me a key to the Queendom Kingdom. And that was a real blessing, is a real blessing. And I will take that key and run with it and see how many doors I can unlock. And I believe
everyone.
I still point. Yes. And I believe I'd been still point breathing all my life. That's why I'd wake up in my sleep especially, because I would either feel like I wasn't getting enough oxygen through my nose because of sinus congestion, or I would feel like I would be asleep, and it would happen, and I'd wake up with a dry mouth. And then, of course, I'd tell myself what the scientific mantra is: oh, it's not, you're not supposed to breathe through your nose unless you're doing heavy duty physical exercise or running from the tire.
You mean through your mouth?
I mean through your mouth, yeah. And I'm saying, maybe a little bit of dry mouth or having to swallow, because I produce a lot of saliva, is worth it. So, any comments about that and how we can manage that so we are actually breathing the way life would have us breathe, what we need to be aware of, the deleterious effects of mouth breathing as opposed to still point breathing?
Yeah. Of course, there's no intimation here that we're suggesting people spend their lives breathing through their mouths.
Exactly.
But in the extreme state of agitation, in the extreme state of emotion, especially emotionally traumatic energy moving the system, their body forces one to go into a form of healing breath, and it's called hyperventilation.
Okay.
And in hyperventilation, of course, it's considered to be a disease, and you put a bag over their mouth so you change the carbon dioxide oxygen ratio, and it eventually shuts down. But the person who's in hyperventilation is in hyperventilation because there's a high emotional charge and a high likelihood of damage from that energy. And the structure is saying, I need to get this out of here. If the person who is the facilitator or is there with the person who's hyperventilating, yes, it is crisis, so it's overdone due to emergency, as oftentimes reactions to emergencies are overdone. But if they simply take that person who's hyperventilating, assure them they're in a safe space, get them to slow the breath down a little bit so it's not so crisis-oriented, then over time, whatever trauma is behind that spontaneous, excessive breath, bring it back into balance, and whatever the system is trying to burn off, it will burn off. And again, I've watched people with just about every kind of trauma in the world. And if someone is in trauma and they will simply breathe into that trauma, it will come to the point where the trauma will simply dissipate and disappear, because it's a natural way for the system to get rid of what doesn't belong. And when one purposely goes into the still point session, in particular, I invite people to breathe through the mouth, because if they're breathing through the nose, the passageways through the sinuses carry oxygen to the brain, and it will tend to keep the brain fired up. And you'll remember I've said many times, in order to heal, you got to be out of your mind. You've got to be willing to let go of that thing. And so by breathing through your mouth, there's not as much oxygen stimulation of the brain, and the brain and its function, it's actually a whole body function, but the function mind tends to go still. And when it goes still, literally, physiologically, as related to trauma, we move out of Satan, move out of the state of resistance to what wants to move, into a state of superconductor. And I've observed in myself and in other people literally the ability in just a minute or two of still point, literally moving through years of old traumatic energies. And my take is, and I go back to my physics training for this, is that in a superconductor, there is no resistance. Satan is the resistor. Got nothing to do with some dude out there. It's the resistance inside of us where we shut down, and by shutting down, we cut that tissue off from literally the active presence of the love of God delivered through the breath. Nothing theological about it, just we're designed to function with this flowing, active present love through us at all times. And letting go of the resistance allows us to move into superconductor state, and that's what moves the energy.
And maybe that's when our bodily cells actually truly become liquid crystal diodes.
Back to their normal state.
There you go. And one last thought, and then I will hang up. One thing I can tell you in relation to this conversation we just had about hyperventilation. Oh, yes, one question. So you bring a person into mouth breathing if they're hyperventilating to give them access to more air so that they can gradually be help them to bring themselves down to a calmer state. Is that what I hear you saying?
Don't encourage. If I come across someone who's in hyperventilation, I will, number one, make physical contact so they know that energetically there's someone there with a loving touch, and I'll invite them to let go of the crisis breath that's pushing so hard, because it is crisis. Come back into a softening state where the continuous flow of breath is there, but it slows down and it's not that pounding, I gotta move this out. And there comes a point where one hits the still point where the breath, as opposed to being held, spontaneously stops. That's the still point. And that's where we are physiologically, emotionally, energetically in a superconductor state. And whatever the system's ready to dissipate will dissipate in an instant. And so just the safety and the assurance that you're safe and you can slow the breath down to a point. Yes, we want you to continue this pattern. We don't want you to continue pounding on yourself with it. I mean, you can take anybody and just put them into a pounding breath. And I've had people who, let's say, come to intensives and we're going to do still point breathing. I remember we had one particular medical doctor. And this guy just loved all the physical sensations of and, you know, I've got a room full of people doing still point, and I'm saying, wait a minute, slow it down. No, you don't need to. Oh, but I like this tingling. And it's like, yeah, but it's not getting you anywhere as far as your healing goes.
Yeah.
So slowing down.
Beautiful.
And when that still point happens,
Michael,
whatever the root of the trauma is, the breath is also, you know, it may be something I don't like that it happened. In a billion years, I wouldn't choose for that to happen, and it did, and I can be at peace with it, whatever it was.
And isn't that the role of a facilitator, is to help the person learn how to be their own facilitator and do the work themselves?
Yes, ultimately.
And to know when they need to reach out for help, and when they're okay, they can facilitate themselves. Yeah.
Absolutely. Nothing like a little help from our friends.
Thank you so much. I am complete.
All right, dear heart, breathing with you.
And we have another hand up.
Awesome. Let's say hello.
It's Jamuna, 808. You're on the air.
Welcome, young lady.
Aloha, kakahiaka. How's everybody?
Aloha. We're rocking, doing well, thank you.
Awesome. So I have a couple of questions. Number one, what sheet are you talking about?
What sheet?
Is that the wake-up sheet? Like when you do like
we have many different worksheets. If you go to the website, there's a whole section with different worksheets for different workshops. But generally speaking, we're talking about doing a worksheet. We're generally talking about doing the reality management forgiveness process.
Okay.
Yes. That's it.
Okay.
The one that's presented in Why Is This Happening to Me Again?
Okay. Now I get that now. Okay. I just wanted to double check because I didn't know, because there is several sheets. Yeah. And then,
right.
So, my next question, my next thing is, okay. So, let's say that there's the situation. Yeah, let's say there's a story of like a brother, you know, say, you know, you felt like you should have done something. Like they had the whole time to tell you something, and so what it felt like is betrayal. I bring the breath to feeling about the betrayal. Like I could go on the whole story, but I really don't want to because it's not useful. But
right.
Like because everything's a construct in my mind. What's going on is it's a situation for me to forgive whatever's bothering me. Correct?
Well. I wouldn't language it that way, because for me, what that would imply is what this person out here did is bothering me, and therefore I'll forgive them. And we're never going to suggest that you ever forgive anybody ever for anything. In fact, never forgive anybody, including yourself, for anything. If you have a brother that does something that brings disturbance about betrayal up in you, then you may choose to pardon your brother. You know, what you did was really inappropriate, unconscionable, terrible, whatever word I'd give it, and I can pardon you, I can let you off the hook for that, or not. That's totally irrelevant to forgiveness, but let's say I choose to pardon you for that, and then I realize that when you did that behavior, it brought up all of this pain and trauma about being betrayed. And so now my forgiveness work is to go inside myself and literally remove the energy of betrayal that my brother has brought up in me. So once I forgive that, once I'm free of that, I turn around and my brother does that again tomorrow, and I look at him and I roll my eyes and go, oh, well, there he goes again. But there's no trauma left in me to move in resonance with what he did. I'm free because I forgave in me what the disturbance was. Most of us in this culture, by the age of about 4, because of the way the culture works, because of the way our family systems work, are literally very dedicated, devout, card-carrying members of the one world universal religion of blame. Look what they did to me. But if they did what they did and there was no trauma in me about it, I'd look and I go, oh, they did what they did. That was not good. In fact, you know what? That's a criminal offense. And as a member of this society, I'm going to pick up the phone and call the police and have them held accountable for their criminal offense. But there's their behavior, if it resonates something painful or traumatic in me, oh my God, I've been so betrayed, that's such a terrible thing. That's my work. That's my breath that's being held in order not to deal with the betrayal energy that's going up in me. So, in fact, what my brother has done, and maybe, just as a theory, maybe this brother is a totally and completely enlightened person who decided to give themselves in sacrifice to you to give you the opportunity to look at this trauma you hold about being betrayed. And as you do your forgiveness work around being betrayed, which is driven by a goal that you held for him, and in a situation where, you know, you told me a little bit in the text and now in the conversation, I could imagine there could be many goals that would be related to this. And the real core of forgiveness happens when I identify the exact goal that I'm holding that's driving my trauma. So the goal might be an issue of honesty. You know, he betrayed me because he lied to me. So my goal might be for him to just be honest with me. The goal that drives my pain about being betrayed might be about not being treated honorably. So the goal that would bring my healing about might be the canceling of the goal for him to honor me. The goal might be, you know, the guy down the block really suffered as a result of what he did, and my goal might be that he should have taken care of Bill, who was very badly hurt by what he did. So the more precisely I can identify the exact goal my mind is using in this situation at this moment, and in the Aramaic language, the word forgive is shabag or shabak, it means to cancel. When I get to the just the right goal, the precise goal that's driving my pain, then when I cancel or shabag that goal is what's driving my mind, my carbon-based memory system, to use this unresolved pain. And when I cancel that goal, that unresolved pained construct in my mind collapses. And just like the 9/11 towers did when that attack happened, that building collapsed into its own footprint.
Uh-huh.
The structure in my mind of pain, when I cancel the right goal, collapses into its own footprint. And now I have access to my own unconscious mind, and I get to clean it out. And it's thanks to what that brother did.
Jai. So you say about canceling the right goal. That's the right goal is the ego's goal, yeah?
The ego's goal. What is it? If I looked at this situation, what precisely is, if I were in total control of this brother, what precisely would I be wanting him to do? That's the goal, you know, the precise outcome that I want. That's the goal that's driving my mind to use this pain in me to build my brain's image of my brother. If I didn't have any pain in me around it, my brother would do that same exact behavior, and I'd look and go, oh, brother, you know that's not appropriate. But my physiology wouldn't be going nuts because of my unresolved pain. And so every time my physiology is going nuts in response to something, rather than blaming that something for the fact that my physiology is going nuts, is to delve into, to breathe into, to access in my physiology what this trauma is about. And it might be, you know, a memory that goes back. We had a fellow who did our codependence to interdependent self-study intensive, and he had completed, he did the whole intensive in about 8 months, which was pretty quick. And at the end of it, he was just like we do a personal code evaluation. His scores had improved like beyond what would anyone who's really seriously doing their work would do. So he completed that, and a couple of weeks later, and of course he was really rocking and doing well and feeling good. And a couple of weeks later, he called me, and I was like, Michael, I need support. I don't know what to do with this. I've crashed. And what happened for him was, and he called into the show actually for support. He had been really tapping in and doing a deep enough level of work that a new level of healing crisis happened for him. And he literally went back and remembered his father, who at the beginning of World War II, his mother was a German nurse, Nazi, and a prostitute. And he remembered that, and he had the actual memory surface of his father being 2 and 3 years of age and literally drinking out of mud puddles to get hydration.
Ooh. Wow.
And remembered the first time his father climbed up on a bar stool and started drinking and became an alcoholic his whole life long. And that whole scenario that unfolded in his worksheet process then went to the memory of when he was young and he had a younger brother, and his younger brother just went totally psychotic. And and relationship to the father abusing him with alcohol. And that whole process, I mean, that was just huge for him to process emotionally, physiologically, mentally. But that's the kind of stuff that we're all carrying around, that rare is the person who's willing to do the level of work that they're ever going to have the skill of being able to go in and access that kind of energy and forgive it from their structures. But ultimately, you know, that's the skill that each person needs to develop and the level of process that each one ultimately needs to go to.
Yeah.
There's actually a great movie out there, if you haven't seen it, that ties in on this particular or one aspect of this point. In fact, I was talking with someone about it today, and I made a decision to maybe go back and watch it again myself. But if you haven't seen the film, It's a Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood.
Oh, okay.
It's a story about Mr. Rogers. Well, actually, it's not a story about Mr. Rogers. It's a story written by a writer who worked for Esquire magazine and had been assigned to do a 400-word article on Mr. Rogers. Esquire magazine was doing a series on American heroes. And this guy was assigned to interview and write a 400-word article of Mr. Rogers. And he was a pretty nasty guy, very bad reputation, and he didn't want to do it. And his editor forced him and said, if you want to keep your job here, you're going to do this interview. And he's like, well, why am I interviewing this guy? He said, because your reputation is so negative, he's the only one of these American heroes that would agree to be interviewed by you.
Wow.
And this guy ends up reluctantly going to see Mr. Rogers. And the scene, there are several scenes in it. The one that really strikes home with his principle of, you know, and the basic principle that I see in this movie, anyway, the brain cells I have that I see with people that I work with is, don't make me look at my life. And there's a scene in it where Mr. Rogers is starting to get kind of personal with this guy. I mean, this guy's supposed to be interviewing him for a simple 400-word article. But this guy becomes so agitated, he's in interview with Mr. Rogers, who's, you know, a pretty world-famous guy, and Mr. Rogers is starting to turn the tables on him and ask him questions and process him to the point where the guy gets up and leaves the interview. He walks out of Mr. Rogers' office because Mr. Rogers is bringing him close to things in his own mind that he doesn't want to look at. You know, it's like, don't make me look. And the movie actually was written by this guy, it was based on, once he went through becoming acquainted with, interviewing, becoming friends with Mr. Rogers, and the impact that Mr. Rogers had on his life as a presence of love for him, he ended up writing a 10,000-word article that became a feature article about Mr. Rogers in Esquire magazine. That's what the movie's about. Comes out of that 10,000-word article that he ended up writing, because Mr. Rogers totally transformed his life. But there's a great scene, or a couple of them actually, where it's like, this guy is the epitome of the ego. Don't make me look. That's kind of interesting. And it's just, I mean, it's real life, real, and it's how people do it. It's like, somebody's getting too close to something I don't want to deal with. Get out of my life. Don't make me look at this in me. But ultimately, if we ever going to heal, we have to look at everything that's in there.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. I'm definitely inspired to watch that film now. Yeah.
It's powerful. It's powerful. I mean, literally, Mr. Rogers... You know, this guy ends up talking to Mr. Rogers' wife at one point, and he's like amazed. How does this guy do this? And she tells him that he has a daily practice that he does, and Mr. Rogers kind of explains his daily practice. This isn't just some kind of haphazard thing that happens to happen. He has practices that he does every day that have empowered him to become the kind of teacher and healer that he is. He primarily worked with little kids, but he transformed this guy's life so powerfully that, again, he writes a 10,000-word article that gets published as a feature article in Esquire magazine. And you can Google the article. You can go and, you know, read the article, what this guy went through with Mr. Rogers. It's pretty cool.
Awesome. Yeah.
Yeah, good lesson in willingness.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you so
much that, Michael. Yeah, I was going to ask you another question, but I understand that there's people that want to have, you know.
No, you're with us. You've got the space. It's your floor. Go ahead with your question.
Okay. Let's say if I see someone that's being hostile towards me, that's my perception.
Right.
And they're acting
yep.
out. That's really me putting it there because there's something in me. I know it's a dumb question, maybe, but maybe not.
No, it's not. It's actually a very good question.
Yeah.
So here would be my input on it. If my perception is that this person's being hostile to me, if my mind's constructing a construct that says this person's hostile to me, and I'm in a state of peace, I'm probably seeing this person accurately, and they're probably being hostile toward me.
Yeah.
If my perception, my mind constructs an hostile perception about this person being hostile toward me, then what my mind is telling me is that I have hostility that I could be forgiving. And the constructs of a person's mind always tell more about that person than the world they think they're looking at. So if I'm hostile about this person being hostile, I might be the only hostile person involved in the interaction. There's no hostility from them at all. I can't tell. But I know that if my construct, my mind's construct is hostile, then I have some forgiveness to do around hostility. Maybe this other person does as well, and maybe they don't. It's really difficult to tell if my mind is in hostility.
Okay.
All hostility and fear-based energy in a human mind is corrupt data and is building a construct in the mind that is based in corrupted information. Corrupted perceptual constructs in a person's mind tells them that their mind is lying to them. So the first order of business is clean up my mind, and then, you know, I may see this person really is hostile. In fact, they're so hostile they're not safe to be around. I'm going to say thanks, but I'm not going to be around. I'm not going to play in this kind of dangerous zone. But if I have a hostile response and I'm like, well, I'm out of here. I'm out of this relationship. I'm gone. Well, if you're hostile in a hostile relationship and you leave, and maybe you're being threatened and it's reasonable to leave, person is, make sure you keep doing your work to clean up your hostility, or you're going to have to create somebody else to play this hostility
yeah.
out with. So, you know, everybody has their own standard, and we're one. You know, people often say to me, well, when should I leave? Well, that's not up to me to determine. You leave whenever you choose to leave. But if you leave with an unresolved energy of pain, better clean up the pain or you're going to have to find somebody else to do it with. And there'll never be an easier time to clean up pained perception than this moment. The next, if I don't clean it up now, I add energy to it, the next moment's going to be more intense. If I don't clean it up, then the next moment it happens is going to be still more intense. So there'll never be an easier time to do the forgiveness work that needs to be done than this moment, would be my input.
Yeah. Thank you. That's very helpful.
Honored.
That's what I asked for. Did I help others too? I'm sure it did. And
that's the idea.
Yeah.
We're all in this together.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. Okay. Well, I'm sending aloha and thank you again. I'm gonna head off now and just listen.
Receiving the energy of your aloha and returning it, and thank you for your questioning mind and your process so that we could square up a couple more principles that who knows will help besides us.
Yes. Thank you again.
All right, dear heart. Glad to be on the team. All right, blessings.
Blessings.
All right. Well, Miss Jeannie, we've got about 10 minutes left.
There are no other hands up. However, along the lines of what you were just talking to Jamuna about, I had worked with someone the other day, and they were kind of in a similar situation of what they were feeling, and yet another person came into their space and supposedly an authority and told them that they were in a abusive relationship and needed to get out. And to her, that the other person is projecting what's probably in their own mind and their own being onto her, and that she needed to watch what she bought into. Do you have anything to add to that? It's kind of along the same lines you were talking about. If she held hostility or fear, that it would be resonated by the other person, and that just leaving was not going to be her answer, but that she had to clean up what was in her that was being resonated by it. I told this other person too, I said, you know, it's your choice to leave or stay. I said, but if you leave out of hostility or fear, you're going to make a mistake or make up something that you'll probably regret.
Right. Making decisions out of corrupt data is a deadly thing to do. And what often happens, I remember one particular therapist that I was fairly well acquainted with and knew had gone on and how she treated others in her relationships. And there was someone who was a mutual acquaintance who went to her as a therapist. And she gave him certain advice, similar to the advice that you're just talking about, that this person was given. And having personal knowledge of this therapist, that was she gave the client the exact advice that she had followed. She was telling the client, oh, you better do this. And it's, you know, it's that whole projection game again. So yeah, make sure that if you're working with a therapist, that the therapist is not or has not been in the same boat as you are and is giving you the advice that they followed themselves, because a lot of that kind of stuff is projection, and the therapist is actually therapying themselves. They're not therapying the client at all, and I think that's true in a lot of cases. Does that fit?
Yes.
Cool. Sweet. Well, if you're out there in listener land, we're down to about 8 or 9 minutes. And
not
I would rather
sure,
have a conversation.
I think Susan's hand might have gone up again, so I'm going to turn on her microphone.
Oh, cool.
610,
well,
you're on the air.
Hi, guys.
Hey, young
yeah.
lady.
Yeah, my hand. Hi. Just a teeny report. When Lent started, I started reading my mother's letters. And you and I talked about it, Michael.
Right.
And it's amazing, but about 2 days after Easter, I finished the pile, reading mostly just one a day.
Right.
And I just want to say it has made a big difference, but not in an obvious or dramatic way. It's just that I saw how much she loved all of her children and how lavish she was in expressing her love for us and me on paper. And so it's just allowed me to kind of isolate the episodes when we were small and to see them in a better perspective. That's not really new, but yet I feel differently, and somehow it has affected, I don't know how this is, my relationship with Michael in the basement.
Right.
I asked you last week, sometimes you have to like the person that you're holding a space of love for, and you were very kind. You said, well, maybe not, you know. I mean, you have to hold the space as love, but don't like them necessarily. Well, so I gave up the goal of liking or loving Michael. I just gave it up and said, you work with me. You, if anything's going to happen, it's going to be you doing it, because I have too many shoulds, too many cultural things. But somehow reading my mother's letter, mainly the part about Michael is she worried terribly about my youngest sister. Every letter, practically, telling me something about my little sister and how she was or wasn't doing something or how much trouble she was in. My mother worried about her all the time.
Right.
And I just think that sometimes, well, I guess we're all doing the best we can, and sometimes it's awfully messy and not very good. So,
well,
anyway, I've just, yeah, go ahead.
I was just saying my offering would be that I suspect by reading those letters, perhaps some of the environmental or inherited hostility that you had experienced with her was displaced or transmuted by your tapping into her as the presence of love in your life for those times when she wasn't able to express it. And as you heal that inherited or environmentally reinforced pain, fear, hostility in yourself, then it would seem like when you turn to another object of attention that in the past has been able to resonate that, it's no longer there to be resonated. You're free of it.
That might be true. Yeah, I feel as if my... the circumference of my field of being able to accept variations in human expression has gotten a lot wider.
Nice. That's awesome.
So, anyway, thanks for...
Sweet piece of work.
You gave me a mind shifter to give up the past. That is an ongoing exercise. And
yes.
Somehow reading about the past and getting a truer picture of the past is helping me let go of the past, too.
Yeah.
So.
Well, that is a laudable piece of work. And I bet your mom is dancing in celebration of your liberation from her... the impact of her imperfect responses to you. And as you pass that on, being able to embrace in deeper ways those whose expression is imperfect is kind of one of those gifts that just keeps on giving, I suspect.
That's a good way of putting it. I'm hoping so. Yeah, it feels that way. So, happy Easter.
Happy Easter, and as you talk about this, how's your jaw doing?
My jaw?
You notice, if you just pay attention to your physiology, are you notice anything about your jaw?
No.
No? Okay. I was just wondering, I was feeling a little bit of tension in my jaw as I was listening and having this conversation, and it's often a signal that I'll ask, am I, you know, is this mine or is it yours? And if it's yours, pay attention to it, and it'll open on a new level. So it's probably just all mine.
Well, who knows?
But that's one of the signals I look for.
Oh, really? Okay. It's a way of, you mean being angry, holding anger, clenching teeth, that sort of thing?
It might be. Yeah, it could be.
Yeah.
And as I relax it on a new level in physiology, literally, mind energy release happens, and I'm not as impacted by it any longer.
Okay, well, I'm sure I was doing things physiologically, but I wasn't aware it was in my mouth. But anyway.
Well, and it may have been totally mine. That's why I always, when I have that kind of a signal, I always ask rather than tell.
Oh, okay.
Cool.
All right.
Awesome. Well,
that's it.
Joining you in that breath that just let go.
And thank Jeannie for her text. She was very nice to me.
All right, dear heart. We appreciate you.
Thanks. You too. Okay.
All right. Everybody, join us in having the best year yet of your eternal life. It is an awesome gift to give the world. And thanks for being with us today.